Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to begin this hour by talking with my friend Dr. Gregory Popchick. Undoubtedly, many of us know the problem of the tendency in modern parenting to over-pathologize our kids. When issues arise, we're being told by the culture, and frankly, many parents see this as a quick fix. We try to resolve the problem with diagnoses and medication. Greg, as a counselor, from a psychological perspective, shares with us very clearly that sometimes we can overplay that hand. And in fact, talking about a diagnosis of things like ADHD or any other diagnosis for a child in terms of their behavioral issues, especially if they're under 7, might well be premature and, frankly, potentially irresponsible if we haven't tried other methods of proper remediation. And so Greg and Lisa run the Catholic HOM Households on Mission Network to provide resources that can help us to shy away from over-pathologizing. Now, they don't negate the fact that sometimes medical help can be necessary, sometimes. But long before we even think of that route, there are other things that can be done naturally. It is possible to over-pathologize our children. Many times, that's not even the best course of treatment. It doesn't solve the problem. It just creates favorable outcomes that we can tolerate, but it doesn't remediate the underlying issue. And so Greg is going to share with us about this. After that, I want to talk about the anniversary of the passing of Robin Williams. The reason why I want to talk about this is because his is one of those deaths that I find myself thinking about every once in a while with a tremendous sense of loss and sadness. Robin Williams, whether I like it or not, whether many people like it or not, was a big part of my childhood and the childhood of many people in my generation and my adolescence as well. And frankly, as a fan of The Lord of the Rings, I have secretly lamented Peter Jackson not casting Robin Williams as Tom Bombadil. I think it would have been magnificent. But I think about his passing and I realize that there are lessons that we as Christians can learn. That the sufferings of the comedian, the tears of the clown, if you will, is a real problem. And frankly, we might be surrounded by people who put on that facade when in reality they are spiraling in isolation. And the solution might well be you and I reaching out to them with a loving hand. And then finally, we speak with Dan Philpott about how the Bible's justice can resolve our sense of justice. For now, the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, August 11th. It's the Feast of St. Clare of Assisi. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Pope Leo XIV has chosen disarming technology, serving peace, politics as preventive responsibility as his themes of the 2027 World Day of Peace. Observed on January 1st, the announcement referenced Leo's encyclical Magnifica Humanitas, highlighting his appeal to civil leaders to prioritize humanitarian principles and shared responsibility. More than 200 people have died after a magnitude 7.4 earthquake striking Colombia yesterday. More than 2,700 people are missing as rescue crews search for survivors trapped under collapsed buildings. An airport catering truck reportedly helped President Trump secretly board a smaller U.S. military aircraft while leaving from the NATO summit in Turkey last month. The Washington Post said the decision happened during what intelligence officials described as a credible Iranian threat against the president. Trump had arrived in Ankara on July 8th aboard a new Boeing 747-8 donated by Qatar, but security concerns led to officials to switching planes on the tarmac. The president of the American Academy of Pediatrics and American Medical Association are calling President Trump's new executive order on childhood vaccines as dangerous. Trump says the order would split the childhood MMR vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella into 3 shots. The order would also push for all childhood immunizations to be administered at separate medical visits instead of just one visit. 6 states are having primary elections today. All eyes are on a Democratic primary race for Wisconsin governor, where Democratic socialist Francesca Hong has skyrocketed in the polls. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Media. I'm blessed to be joined by my dear friend, Dr. Gregory Popchick. He and his bride, Lisa, co-host More to Life on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. They're also the founders of CatholicCounselors.com and the founders of the Catholic HOM app, Households on Mission. Greg, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
As usual, the joy is completely mine. I want to begin by talking about something that you had brought to our attention, which is we have a tendency in modern parenting today to very quickly pathologize children. And I know that painting with a broad brush here, but just share with us what we mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, so on the one hand, there's a good trend, which is the reduced stigma of mental health, the increased awareness of mental health issues. And so I appreciate that parents are more sensitive to and open to seeking help for potential mental health problems in their children or in their families. That's a good thing. The downside of that is that we are falling into a tendency to pathologize childhood in general. And so, you know, when a child is struggling to listen or follow through, automatically there's a diagnosis of ADHD, or maybe my child needs medication. There's a diagnosis of pervasive demand avoidance, which is actually a symptom of autism. But TikTok is actually saying that label can be applied to any child who doesn't follow through or doesn't consistently listen, which is an abuse of that term. You know, we have a tendency to think that if there's a parenting problem that I don't know how to solve immediately, then maybe my child is broken in some way. And I want to be sensitive to that need and get them the help that they need. But the problem is that 9 times out of 10, childhood and even adolescent behavior problems can be addressed by better parenting skills or a calmer family environment. And if we don't address those things first and start looking for more exotic solutions, we can actually set up kind of a chain of failure for our kids because we're giving them the wrong help at the wrong time in our attempts to be sensitive to what they might actually need.
And before we talk about a proper, more virtuous way of dealing with the issue, I wonder if you could also share with us how we got here and what are some of the ways in which this is manifesting today?
Well, I think, you know, social media plays a big role in it. You know, everybody's an expert on TikTok and Instagram, and you know, and it's hard to know who to listen to, right? And so people throw out a lot of really interesting or ideas or things that sort of sound like, well, maybe that is my kid. And as I was saying, because we have a greater sensitivity and an openness to mental health issues, I don't want to ignore warning signs that there might be something seriously wrong with my child. And so I want to get them the help that they need early. And I think that's a very good impulse. But it's a case of a little knowledge being a dangerous thing, where all of a sudden, you know, and this is something that's typical for, like, you know, psychology students or even medical school students. You know, you go to school and you start learning about all these disorders and you think, well, I have that, or gosh, I have a symptom of that, or this person, I know. And we start putting people into holes and it takes a while to really realize that, you know, not everybody's diagnosable. You know, sometimes they're just quirks, or sometimes these are things that we need to work through, and we need to start there. And in fact, they teach you, both in psych grad school and medical school, that there's an aphorism that when you hear hoofbeats, you need to look for horses before you look for zebras. The idea being that, you know, when you're looking for a solution to a problem, you need to start with the most common explanations of the problem before looking for more exotic explanations or even more exotic solutions. So when it comes to child behavior problems, we really want to start by saying, do I have the skills that I need to help this child get where they need to go? And really start working there first before I start looking for letters and a pill to apply to my child.
So if I may stretch the analogy a little, have we come to a point perhaps, and please correct me if I'm wrong, where we now think that the horses are, in fact, give them a diagnosis, give them a pill?
Yeah, I mean, when we hear the hoofbeats, and so automatically we think zebras. So there's got to be a diagnosis, there's got to be a pill for this. Instead of thinking, you know, well, maybe with some different skills or a little more structure or a little more focus on having an orderly marriage and family life, that would do the trick. And honestly, 9 times out of 10, that's what the child needs. But sometimes we feel like, well, I don't know how to do that. So it's just easier to say my child has this diagnosable problem that can be fixed with a pill or by somebody else counseling them. And again, as a counselor, as a marriage and family counselor, I'm certainly more than happy to work with couples and families about these kinds of issues. But in my work with them, I find that 9 times out of 10, the biggest issue is just needing to have better parenting skills, needing to work a little bit more on having a loving and calm ordered marriage and family life as well, because kids are symptom bearers. They're like barometers. They pick up on the stress in the household, and the stress in the household ramps them up. So they start behaving erratically or impulsively. They feed off the tension in the house, and they become signs of that tension. And so if we're not being aware of the level of conflict in the house or the level of chaos in the house, it's going to be reflected in our kids' behavior. And that can't be solved with a pill.
So share with our parents listening right now some of the more common things that will result in, let's just say, undesirable or not ideal child behavior, and therefore the proper common remedies for these.
Well, so I think, you know, there are a couple of different ways to approach that question. Let's say a child is impulsive. Let's say we're talking about a kid who's like 4 or 5. So let's say a boy who's really rambunctious, who's active, who doesn't necessarily connect actions with consequences, you know, and then you send that kid to school. Immediately, you're going to get feedback from that kid's teacher that says maybe they have ADHD. The thing about that is, and this is a little bit of a hot take, but it's kind of irresponsible to diagnose ADHD before age 7 or 8. And I'll explain why. Because until then, kids can't consistently connect actions and consequences. And so if you're saying that a child has a disorder of impulsivity, that means that they ought to be able to connect actions and consequences consistently, and something is preventing them from being able to do that. Now, before 6 or 7, since kids can't consistently connect actions and consequences, they are just by nature impulsive. And so they need structure, and they need guidance, and they need attention, and they need coaching on how to connect actions and consequences and follow through with things and be able to have a little bit more self-control and focus. They don't learn to do those things unless we teach them. But too often we're throwing around that label of ADHD with kids who are in, you know, preschool or in kindergarten. And these are children who have not achieved the developmental and neurological maturity to be able to do the things that a child should be able to do in order to have the diagnosis of ADHD. So, and we do that with a lot of different things. And so, you know, when it comes to especially younger children, we need to make sure that we've got the structure in place, the kind of support and coaching and appropriate developmental expectations regarding their behavior before we start saying, well, this is a disorder.
It's become a go-to, like you said. We hear hoofs, see zebras, we throw pills at the situation, and then we revel in the fact that now the child is easier to manage. But in a lot of ways, isn't that just trying to mask the symptoms without going to the root cause?
Yeah, and more often than not, it doesn't actually work. I mean, you know, there's some people who will, you know, will say will have a positive experience with that approach. But more often than not, what it does is it sets up a situation where the child's behavior isn't necessarily improving and things aren't necessarily getting better. And so now the parent feels like, I've failed as a parent, and now the medical establishment has failed my child too. And there's nothing that we can do to fix this kid, and they're just broken for life. And it sets up this sort of pattern of failure, because success builds on success and failure builds on failure. And so my encouragement to parents, whether I'm on the radio or working with them personally through CatholicCounselors.com, is let's look at what it would take for you to help your child have the support and structure they need to learn these skills, as opposed to just saying the absence of these skills necessarily constitutes a disorder. We could walk through that step by step in a thoughtful way. We can really discern what's going on and identify whether there really is a deeper problem happening here, or if it's something that can be handled with either somewhat better parenting skills or a different dynamic in the household that isn't so stressful that it's feeding the child's stress temperature.
Which means, in a lot of ways, this is going to go back to parents not only parenting well, but also working hard on creating a harmonious family dynamic in the home.
That's absolutely right. And none of this, by the way, is to shame or blame parents. This is to empower parents. You know, it's a horrible feeling as a parent to feel like I'm not giving my kid what they need to succeed. And I'm saying that you don't have to feel that way. The answers are there. And in most cases, with the right skills, you can be what your child needs you to be to get them where they need to go. It's just a matter of learning those steps. And so the answers are there. You can learn them and use them and be successful without feeling like, my child is broken. And by working with the right people, you can evaluate whether those skills are enough and whether you need more support from there, and take it in a stepwise way. But don't reach for the diagnosis the first thing because you saw something on TikTok or a friend told you or even the teacher told you. Really look at what needs to happen and what skills can you use to help that child get to that place.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchuk. He is Bright Lisa, co-host More to Life on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. They're also the developers of the Catholic HOM, Households on Mission app. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Life is hard and we have to struggle against so much, including the ongoing struggle against our own sinfulness. And sometimes we just want to say, no more, I'm done. But God isn't done with you. I'm Dr. Marcus Peter, and in my book, Not Finished Yet, I can show you how God has already begun a wondrous work in you, in each of us, and only needs your cooperation. Find Not Finished Yet and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian prayer series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking, and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter. Today is the anniversary of the death of Robin Williams, and his is a death I find myself thinking about quite a bit. He was one of the voices of my childhood. In fact, if anything, I think few celebrity deaths have struck my entire generation with the strange sadness than Robin Williams' death. I think largely because few actors occupied such a permanent place within the entertainment imagination of our childhood and adolescence. Think about it. Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire, Dead Poets Society, Hook, A Good Morning Vietnam, Jumanji, Patch Adams. I could go on and on. Good Will Hunting, even Night at the Museum. His voice and his face have become woven into a kind of cultural memory for many of us. I think the deepest shock from his death didn't come from the fact that Hollywood lost one of its greatest performers. Hollywood, just like every other secular sphere, they always find another person to fill the gap. The secular sphere is a relentless machinery that churns out product. No, I think the greatest sadness here is that this was a man who spent his entire career persuading millions through his movies and TV shows that life was worth living and worth laughing through. And yet he himself reached a place where he could no longer persuade himself of the very narrative he was sharing with others. There's a famous story of a man who goes to the doctor and he goes, "Doctor, I'm depressed." The man says, "Life is harsh, it's unforgiving, it's cruel," and the doctor lights up. The treatment, after all, is simple. "The great clown Grimaldi is in town tonight," and the doctor says, "Go and see him, that should sort you out." And the man bursts into tears. "But doctor," he says, "I am Grimaldi." Joseph Grimaldi is credited as the father of modern clowning. He created the iconic white face makeup, colorful baggy look. Offstage, Grimaldi suffered from severe depression, chronic physical pain from his acrobatic stunts, a failing marriage, and the tragic death of his son. That story, many of us probably know, because every generation recognizes some kind of a terrible truth from it. We, I think, understand that public laughter frequently hides a very private form of anguish. Psychologists have called this pattern the sad clown paradox, or the tears of a clown, if you've heard of it. Now, several studies have explored elevated rates of depression and psychological distress amongst comedians. largely because their occupation requires emotional performance and their personal interior lives tend to be profoundly isolated. Comedy demands extraordinary sensitivity. A comedian must first understand pain before he knows how to transform pain into laughter. And so the greatest humor frequently emerges from hearts that have become unusually familiar with pain and sorrow. There's a quote that's attributed to Charlie Chaplin that struck a chord with me. The quote goes like this: "To truly laugh, you must be able to take your pain and to play with it." Robin Williams mastered precisely that. And that's a difficult art, mind you. I don't think I have remotely that capacity, and I've not been described as very funny as a result. But his improv seemed effortless. He was genuinely brilliant. But that kind of gift grows through interior struggle. He wasn't a man who was perpetually happy. And his films repeatedly preached that one message. Different characters, but almost the same message. Every one of his roles urged viewers towards gratitude and courage and wonder and joyful endurance. Your life is worth living, even if his life was descending into suffering. John Keating, for example, the character he played, inspired poetry students towards finding meaning in life. Dr. Patch Adams preached laughter through medicine. Mrs. Doubtfire, as ridiculous a movie as that was about a father who sacrificed everything just to be a father to his children. And then the genie in Aladdin, well, he liberated many people's dreams simply through laughter. That's why Robin Williams' death is bewildering. His artistic message always seemed permanently directed toward hope. And there's a heartbreaking irony here that I want to draw our attention to. The man whose work consistently encouraged others towards joyful living gradually lost his own ability to embrace the very message he gave so generously. Jim Carrey, a comedian himself, once reflected. He said, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer." I think we should wake up to this. I think our Western culture still tells every generation that success equals happiness or money or fame or achievement, whatever. But none of those things have the power to heal the human heart or the human soul. Augustine reached that conclusion over 16 centuries ago when he confessed to God, "You've made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until it rests in thee." Robin Williams also reminds Christians of another uncomfortable reality. Suffering frequently hides beneath extraordinary competence and exceptional charisma and ordinary life. And this, I think, is the message you and I can learn. Our churches sometimes celebrate smiling faces with impressive enthusiasm, but is it possible that we're overlooking seriously broken hearts that sit faithfully week in, week out in the same pew every Sunday, and they put on an external appearance that remains remarkably convincing, but they are poor instruments for measuring interior health? Scripture repeatedly cautions us against optimism. I mean, look at David. He cries from profound despair in the Psalms. Jeremiah was known as the lamenting prophet for a reason. Elijah begged for death beneath the broom tree. Job wrestled through devastating loss. Even Paul speaks about being utterly burdened beyond his strength. Even in the gospel, Jesus himself is described, in Isaiah 53, Jesus is described as a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. We don't have an emotional utopia in this lifetime. Many Christians, unfortunately, might be disconnected from the pain of our brothers and sisters. We might be tempted to just distribute spiritual cliches whenever someone confesses depression. The simplistic answer requires very little compassion. But sometimes the answer is accompaniment, friendship, patient love, humble listening. The church has always distinguished between spiritual suffering and psychological illness. Human beings are integrated unions. We are body-soul composite beings. Our wounds require both spiritual care and legitimate medical treatment. The Catechism teaches this. Life and physical health are precious gifts entrusted by God. And so prudent care for physical health and mental health represents a genuine moral responsibility. And so when we think of human life, grace works through prayer, but also through friendship and counseling and medicine. And whenever each of these serves authentic human flourishing, then we're living within God's providence. And so remembering Robin Williams' life raises a searching question for every one of us. everyone in the Christian community. How many of our believers faithfully attend Mass every week while secretly enduring profound loneliness because they don't believe that anyone will recognize what they're going through? And let's face it, I think a lot of us might not understand what they're going through. Every parish advertises the concept of fellowship. We schedule programs. My friend Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers reminds us that we have a tendency to program ourselves to death. And we organize committees. We try to get things done. But are we working at cultivating the difficult virtue of honest vulnerability within the parish community? Because the reality is honesty threatens the carefully polished religious appearance. The gospel tells us to break past it. Christ welcomed tax collectors and prostitutes and doubters and failures and, frankly, miserable people too. Even if respectable society doesn't embrace them as acceptable dinner companions. The fathers of the church talk about the church as a hospital, not a courtroom. Hospitals exist for wounded people. So whenever Christians don't remember, whenever we forget that part of being in a hospital means recognizing that our brothers and sisters are hurting in particular ways, and we are the hands and feet of Christ toward their suffering, well, then we can instrumentally be a cause of their deeper isolation. And so remembering Robin Williams' life actually invites you and I to reflect. Think about the conversations we have with people. Have we been present enough that we've given people the room to share the kind of isolation and pain that they might be going through? And also, let's pray for Robin Williams' soul with genuine charity. That's the ancient practice of the church. Let's do so lovingly. But remember that every human soul reaches a place where we might encounter isolation. And sometimes the remedy to that is you inviting them to the love of Christ and seeking the help that they need. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
This program is brought to you in part by Dave Tyson with Real Estate for Life, a faith-based organization, and Texana Bank, offering residential mortgage assistance across all 50 states, including purchases and refinances with conventional FHA and VA loans. More information can be found at re4l.org. Again, that's re4l.org.
All loans subject to credit approval. Texana Bank, NMLS 407536, Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC.
This Ave Maria program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit.
One of the greatest threat to your family isn't a disaster or a virus, but addiction. In nearly every family and every pew, someone is silently struggling. Beginning July 11th, Shalom World TV and the iThirst Initiative present Unshackled, a powerful new series on the Catholic Church's response to the addiction crisis, bringing together leading voices to discuss real healing. Stream it free at shalomworld.org or on the Shalom World app today.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. not with the regularity that I want you to come, not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, I have more than a hunch, that's what he says to me, and I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Sharing meals as a family isn't just about nourishing our bodies. It's about nourishing our spirits and relationships, too. A large body of research points to the many ways that family meals boost the well-being of kids and parents alike. It can be tough for families to consistently make time to sit down and eat together. But when we do, it's like we're saying to one another, "Spending time with you is one of the most important parts of my day." In a way, the table that our family gathers around starts to look a little like the altar at church. It becomes a place for practicing gratitude, experiencing sharing, and building communion. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, visit CatholicHOM.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man. And hey, could you pass the peas? Thanks.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Philpott. He's professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He earned his PhD in 96 from Harvard University, specializes in religion and global politics. We're talking today about how the Bible's justice can revive our justice. Dan, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Yeah, great to be with you, Marcus, and I've loved your show for many years.
Well, I greatly appreciate you saying that. It's very kind of you. And I think a good place for us to begin, especially in terms of your work as well, is this question of justice, especially since, given that we have forgotten an objective, therefore natural law, therefore biblical concept of justice today. Let's just begin on what justice is and why it's so crucial for the functioning and common good of society.
Yes, I'm writing a book about the meaning of justice, and I argue that the Bible contains a very rich and valuable concept of justice that, if we could retrieve it and develop it, could do a lot of good for our politics today. The world has come to be dominated by a notion of justice that is defined as the constant will to render another his due. And this justice is not, affirmed by the church, and due is synonymous with rights. It means give everybody their rights. But if you look at it closely, this conception of justice comes out of classical thought, out of Roman thought. And while rights are not wrong, the Bible contains a much richer and wider meaning of justice. That really means all of the commandments that humans are to live by. And this includes obligations that give others their rights, but it also includes obligations and duties that go beyond rights, such as mercy and generosity and hospitality and gift and forgiveness and reconciliation. And we need all of those. And if we don't have If we only have rights, or if rights are poorly founded or grounded, and if we don't have the other kinds of obligations, then society will suffer.
From there, then, let's focus on how justice is a necessary first principle of society and the common good.
Yes. You know, that what you just said has been affirmed by philosophers dating back to Plato and Aristotle, and all through the tradition up to contemporary philosophers. The thinker John Rawls, the contemporary modern political philosopher, said that justice is the first duty of social institutions, or the first virtue of social institutions. So it is widely thought that justice is the fundamental principle of society and political institutions. And so whatever we think justice is and what it consists of is going to be very important, for whoever captures that turf, the meaning of that concept, succeeds in, putting forth the ideas that they want to see.
The funny thing is,
many people will take a look at that definition of justice, or at least some allusion to it, and immediately go, well, that sounds either rather myopic, or that sounds bigoted, you know, what have you. But the truth of the matter is, from an inherent perspective, we all seem to understand justice from that perspective, especially when you look at things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I invite your thoughts there.
Yeah. So there's, let there be no doubt, I think that rights are a very important moral achievement, especially when they take the form of natural rights or human rights. Thus, we can look at the American founding, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution as great moral achievements, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in fact, popes all the way through the present have strongly extolled the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But rights only have their validity if they are grounded or based in the moral order and based in human nature. And I would argue the most important concept being human dignity. Now, Christians have a very important basis for human dignity, the person created in the image of God. And dignity means the infinite worth or value of the human being. And human beings have infinite worth because they're created in the image of God. Now, here I think Christians actually have a leg up. Secular thinkers typically try to place rights on the foundation of self-interest or radical autonomy, people's right to, just define themselves in whatever way they want to. But Christians point to an objective moral order and human nature that grounds human rights. And so Christian justice should include rights and actually gives them a very strong foundation.
Because of that perspective, too, one of the things that we need to understand is the very concept of justice, this question of rendering due, or like you've rightly been talking about, fulfilling rights. If we look at it from a biblical perspective, the whole concept has to do with we do this so that we can be in right relationship with ourselves and therefore our fellow man and therefore with God.
Yes. And rights are, in fact, a form of right relationship. So if I have a duty not to lie, another person has a right not to be lied to. And my acting according to that duty is a form of right relationship. I'm relating to other people with respect to the good of truth and knowledge. And so all valid rights have this kind of form. They're a form of relationship that values something very important in relations. But I would argue, though, that the Christian tradition in the Bible also gives us other obligations that go beyond rights that are critical for human relationship, such as mercy, you know, the duty to alleviate distress in others, generosity, hospitality, gift, living as a gift towards others, reconciling with enemies, loving enemies, practicing forgiveness. All of these things that go beyond rights are also very important for justice, incorporated into Christian justice, and very important for society. But in the modern world that emphasizes only rights, these other kinds of duties have kind of gone by the wayside. They're considered private or religious or not really relevant to the public good.
The question, like you've rightly mentioned, therefore, becomes how central is this, not just to Western flourishing, but particularly to the language of salvation and therefore Christian life? How central is this question of justice?
Yeah. I mean, one of the remarkable things that when I looked at the Bible and looked at the meaning of justice there, it's represented by the words tzedek or tzedakah in the Old Testament and the dikaiosune in the New Testament. Well, remarkably, justice is used to describe God's salvation of humanity. In the Old Testament, it's used in the book of Isaiah to talk about God's saving justice, also in the Psalms. But in the New Testament, St. Paul uses justice, or dikaiosune, to describe God's work of saving humanity through the cross and resurrection. Now, that's interesting because Christians would agree that what God did for us was not our due. In fact, it was radically beyond our due. It was a gift, right? And so right there in the very central pivotal events of Christianity, we have a justice that is not our due. Now, I think part of the reason why many Christians don't see this wide conception of justice and see this central conception of justice is that because English language Bibles translate these words as both righteousness and justice. So they get divided, and we read righteousness in some places, justice in the other. But because of that, we don't grasp the wide meaning of dikaiosune and tzedek. We don't grasp that those things could include, you know, God's very salvation and could include the great gift that God has given us, and that is far more than what is our due.
And within that perspective, too, that justice is rightly a gift. We have about 20 seconds, just a brief comment on that.
Yes. I mean, in fact, God's salvation of us in part involves paying our due. Due is part of it, but it's also far beyond that. It's something that we didn't deserve. It is a gift. And if Paul is describing that as justice or dikaiosune, well then, justice is something wider and much more holistic than simply what is due.
I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Philpott, professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, and we're talking about justice from a biblical perspective, natural law perspective, and how it's central to not just the Christian revelation, but also flourishing within society. We're going to continue on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You want to pass the Catholic faith on to your children? A very good way is to teach your children at home. You want to protect your kids from the toxic culture that surrounds us? Do you want to have a greater influence in what your kids are learning? Once more, a great way is to teach your children at home. No teacher is going to care about your kids as much as you do. Seton Home Study School is the best way to teach your children at home. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Ever get asked one of those tough questions, like, do Catholics worship Mary? And in that moment, you freeze? Truthfully, the Catholic AI app gives you answers in seconds rooted in scripture, tradition, and the magisterium. Whether you're navigating a tough conversation, deepening your faith, or looking for daily spiritual guidance, Truthfully helps you know, live, and defend the Catholic faith. Truthfully can be found in the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Truthfully, T-R-U-T-H-L-Y.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Does Jesus always answer our prayers? The Catholic Catechism says yes, Jesus always answers prayers offered in faith and quotes our Lord who said, "Your faith has made you well. Go in peace." The Catechism cites three examples where Jesus reacts to three different kinds of prayer. The prayer of faith is expressed by the leper, the Canaanite woman, and the good thief. The prayer of petition is exhibited in the action of the bearers of the paralyzed man and the hemorrhaging woman, who is healed by merely touching Jesus' cloak. Finally, urgent prayer is heard from the lips of the blind men, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." This is remembered today as the Jesus Prayer, "Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner." St. Augustine parses this prayer thusly: Jesus prays for us as our priest, in us as our head, and is prayed to by us as our God. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Reed. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Philpott, Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. So, Dan, we got cut off at the break earlier, but we started touching on this concept of justice as a gift that God gives people, which is beyond a natural law concept and a natural view of justice. Just share with us a little more about that.
Yeah, so in society today, justice is largely seen as what is due or what people have a right to. And, you know, in Catholic thought, we strongly ground that in natural law. And I think those things are very valid and important. But in the Bible, justice is much more than that. And so in the Christian tradition, natural law or reason can be understood to, ground the Ten Commandments. They're knowable by reason, and they involve rights. But in fact, biblical injustice includes much more than that as well, that are supernaturally defined or taught by Jesus. And that would be things like reconciliation, forgiveness, mercy, and so forth. One of the interesting things is that in modern Catholic social thought, after the Second Vatican Council, there was a call to incorporate in Catholic social thought principles that include natural law, but go beyond natural law. Before the council, it was mostly natural law. But so, for instance, John Paul II argued for mercy and reconciliation and forgiveness as principles for social life, for political life. And that was radical. Pope Benedict XVI argued for gift as a key principle of the economy in his encyclical Caritatis and Veritate. And that was also radical. I mean, John Paul II argues for solidarity as rooted in Christ, in the second person of the Trinity. And so there's been an effort to incorporate the supernatural dimension, the supernaturally defined teachings of Christianity and the Bible into Catholic thought, which is something that I think has been very exciting.
And by virtue of that, a proper concept of what Catholic social thought ought to look like, which is a rightful application of Christian charity, including the very perspective of mercy, but not to the deviation from or even the negation of justice, a rightful proportionate application of justice within a Christian paradigm.
Yes. I mean, John Paul II talks about justice as being the claims that are due, and in his encyclical Divis in Misericordia. But then he says something interesting, that love and mercy and these supernatural principles not only complement or go with justice, but they actually sort of define justice and expand it and make it wider. And so they end up, love actually transforms justice and gives us a wider notion of justice, one that does not negate or throw out rights and what is due. I mean, I still think criminals ought to be punished and people should pay their bills and people should get their rights. But it's a justice that is expanded and that is wider than and starts to look like God's justice in the Bible.
And when we look at God's justice as the primary measure of justice, he himself being the just God, we understand that there's nothing that we can do from this side of the veil, especially within our fallenness, to meet up with that justice. And so if God were to be completely, absolutely just in himself and apply that to us, well, we would face our own destruction. But because go on, please.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the teaching of the church is that prior to the cross and resurrection, we, faced punishments for our sins, and that we needed this help, this rescue, this recourse, and without that we would have been faced with the justice of punishment, right? And but then we have God's mercy and God's will to reconcile. And that could be seen by some people as a departure from justice. But I think in the scriptures, it actually expands God's justice, or it could be said as another face of God's justice, ultimately is the central, defining, victorious face of God's justice, is God's mercy and God's will to restore.
Now, precisely because of that, too, we can look at the cross, we can look at Jesus's entire life and call for mercy as an application thereof, of his justice. In fact, Aquinas does not talk about mercy as the negation or undermining of divine justice. He actually calls it the perfection of divine justice.
Yes, that's right. Yes, he does. And that's right. And interesting, because Aquinas, adopts the rendering due definition of justice, which he places in the rule of law, or the treatise on justice in the Summa Theologica. But in other places in the scripture, he sort of gives a nod to this wider notion of justice. And yes, the notion of mercy as a perfection of justice can be found there. And that is strongly resounded by John Paul II in his encyclical on mercy. That's Divus in Misericordia, 1980, where he has a deep meditation on justice and then argues that the meaning can be expanded by mercy.
And therefore, when we look at a proper application of justice from a Christian perspective, we can rightly say, yes, it is completely true that we have to function within the framework of dues. There are things that are due that we cannot shy away from. But at the same time, within that consideration is also this notion of that which exceeds what is due.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And what I want to do in the book is to kind of retrieve this notion from the Bible and develop it and try to understand it, but then apply it, ask, well, what might it mean for modern politics? And so, yes, as you say, we should still have the rights. We should still have what is due. But I think that politics and our social order could benefit a great deal from the principles that go beyond due. Most of those principles have a kind of dynamic of healing wounds or alleviating distress. Most of them revolve around mercy as the chief of this beyond due justice. And so I think that they translate into, you know, caring for the poor, giving people their healthcare, but also an effort to address the wounds of the past. And I think this is very, very important. It's something we don't do very much. And so many of our injustices are sort of derived from wounds of the past. And so the way I discovered this justice by studying countries who were in the process of confronting past injustices after living through a war or dictatorship. And there were many religious voices in these countries, like South Africa would be an example, but Germany and Ireland and so forth, where they've lived through. And in so many of these countries, you had religious voices who were saying, well, yeah, we have to not only restore the law and rights, as many of the secular voices were saying, but we also need healing, mercy, forgiveness, restoration, apology, reconciliation. We have to address these wounds of the past. And I think in American history, we see this in leaders such as Lincoln or Martin Luther King, or who had an argument for rights, to be sure, but also argued for the healing principles of reconciliation, mercy, and forgiveness.
Would it be also therefore proper to acknowledge that within the modern perspective, especially critical progressivist ideological narratives, we see an overt push beyond justice that is due to calls that flatly exceed the call of justice?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think progressivism is wrong on both sides of justice. First of all, they don't have a very good foundation for rights. Rights are either based on self-interest or radical autonomy, or they reject rights altogether. But second of all, when it comes to the past, they often have kind of radical calls for revenge or radical change in society. But there's not much of there's no leaven of forgiveness or unity or healing or solidarity. So I, for one, for instance, think that we have to take very seriously the wounds of racial injustice, of And that needs a lot more healing. But many of the secular voices are just calling for kind of a radical confrontation and radical continuation of the fight. Whereas I think we need something more like solidarity, healing, coming together again, but in a way that seeks to heal these wounds, takes them seriously, but seeks to heal them. So it's a different, it's singing in a different key than a lot of the, you know, prominent voices with regard to racism in our society.
To lend to that conversation, I want to put forward that one of the ways in which we can bring about that rightful ordering is to not err on the excess of the other side, but to reestablish that which is, if we want to use the language of justice, that which is due, which is all men are created by God, bearers of the divine image, and to operate from there as a launching point, rather than attributing constant blame. So forgiveness being key, but also just moving forward from there in terms of, therefore, as bearers of the divine image, we actually have the dignity to move forward.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely critical, as the bearers of the divine image and of human dignity that arises from that. And when we see human dignity, or the preciousness of every human life, human person, we see that as the basis for rights. I actually think it's the strongest basis for rights. Okay. We give people their rights because we respect their dignity and the inviolability of their person. But human dignity is also the basis for you know, humanitarian relief when people have suffered great harms. This is the basis for healthcare and addressing people's suffering and their illnesses and infirmities. But it's also the basis for forgiveness. It's the basis for respecting the life of the person on death row.
So, Dan, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to stop there.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. I've been talking with Dr. Daniel Philpott. He is professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He's also writing a book that sets forth a political theology based on a Christian concept of justice, and that's exactly what we've been talking about. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.